I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and from WUOT News, this is Dialogue. Three years ago, I hosted an edition of this program focusing on the Affordable Care Act and its effects in Tennessee. Much of what our panel discussed that day in 2013 was speculative, because many of the ACA's provisions had not then taken effect. But now, consumers, doctors, hospitals, and insurers are dealing with the effects, both positive and negative, of the controversial law known as Obamacare. Today, we revisit the ACA, health insurance, and you. Join us for Dialogue after this news. Thank you for joining us on Dialogue this Wednesday. Today, the third day of February, 6 minutes after the hour. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth with you here at 91.9 FM, WUOT. Thank you so much for joining us, and today we have an interesting show for you. We always try to have an interesting show, but today perhaps more so than usual, because it's been 3 years since we had a show about the Affordable Care Act and its effects here in Tennessee. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, a lot of what we talked about that day, 3 years ago, was speculative by nature, because we were still waiting on provisions of the Affordable Care Act to take effect. Well, now it's 2016. Hard to believe 3 years have gone by so quickly, and we're talking about the effects of the ACA, health insurance, Insure Tennessee, and the lack thereof, the lack of Medicaid expansion, all these factors that have developed within the last 3 years that affect doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, and of course, all of you. We're going to start this discussion with State Senator Doug Overby. We'll have him in just a second. I do want to introduce some of our other guests. Ed Curtis is the Chief Executive Officer of Summit Medical Group, and Carol Myers, an Associate Professor in the UT College of Nursing. She studies public health policy. We'll hear more from them in about 15 minutes, so stay with us. But for the first portion of our program, we're going to talk to State Senator Doug Overby, who joins us on the phone from Nashville. Why Senator Overby? Because he's a state senator from Merrillville who last year sponsored the legislation that would have enacted Insure Tennessee. That was Governor Bill Haslam's compromise plan to provide health insurance access to thousands of uninsured Tennesseans. Senator Overby, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brandon. It's great to be here with you and Ed and Carol.
Well, wonderful. We're glad to have you, too. For people who didn't quite follow this or have wondered how the discussion has evolved in the last year or so, let's talk about what Insure Tennessee wanted to accomplish. This was a compromise measure that Governor Haslam and others worked on for, what, about a year and a half, trying to get a nice middle ground between the state and the federal government to provide this health insurance. Tell us what Insure Tennessee was supposed to do.
Well, that's correct. In 2012, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the federal government could not force states to expand their Medicaid program. And so it became left up to each state whether to expand Medicaid. A year later, March of 2013, Governor Haslam appeared before a joint convention of the General Assembly and said he would not expand the traditional Medicaid program because he thought the Affordable Care Act was the wrong approach. And that was almost unanimously applauded by the General Assembly, and we encouraged Governor Haslam to find a middle ground, a Tennessee way to provide expanded coverage that was not simply expanding the Medicaid program. And so over the course of about 20 months, Governor Haslam worked with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to come up with a plan that would be a uniquely Tennessee plan to provide health insurance coverage for about 280,000 Tennesseans of working age who either didn't have insurance through their employer or whose income was insufficient for them to obtain private coverage.
And it would do that through a distributing money from the federal government, right? Like it would be sent here to Tennessee and then distributed to those folks so they could go out and purchase their own insurance, right?
That's correct. The funding would have come through the Affordable Care Act, but I think it's important to note that these folks who qualified for Insure Tennessee would not be simply added to the TennCare rolls. Therefore, this was not just an expansion of Medicaid, but it was a completely new program. You might call it a pilot program that would have been in effect for 2 years with plenty of circuit breakers in the event the federal government ceased to fund the program or broke its promises to the state. Tennessee could have gotten out of the program. And it's also important to note that this would have been without cost to the Tennessee taxpayers because the federal government, through taxes already levied and collected, would have funded Insure Tennessee at 100% through the end of this year, through the end of 2016. And at that point, the funding would have gone down to 90% from the federal government. And the other 10% would have been made up from the voluntary hospital assessment that has been in place for the past 6 years. So the general fund of state government would not have been paying for Insure Tennessee.
There were indications from the start, Senator, that legislation was going to be a bit of an uphill climb. We started to see more questions being asked the closer Governor Haslam got to announcing the plan. So what kind of reaction were you expecting as the Senate sponsor of this legislation?
Well, you're right. I think it did get off to a rocky start in that generally when the majority party in the Senate and the governor are of the same party, the Senate majority leader carries the governor's legislative package.
That's right, yeah.
In this case, the majority leader declined that opportunity. And when that happened, I was grateful that Governor Haslam turned to me and asked me if I would be willing to consider carrying his signature legislative piece. I went into it fully optimistic for a couple of reasons. One, the governor had just recently won re-election with over 70% of the general election vote and otherwise had very high popularity ratings throughout the state, which said to me the governor has been across the state of Tennessee, has been promoting Insure Tennessee. The reaction to that has been favorable. So I went into the special session the first week of February of 2015 with high hopes.
Well, a Vanderbilt University poll, even as recently as this December, just a couple of months ago, found that 64% of Tennesseans supported Insure Tennessee. And what was even more striking to me is that included 4 out of 10 people who described themselves as Tea Party adherents. So it seemed like it had a wide base of support from the public, from the folks who elected you and your colleagues to the legislature. So why did the legislature seem so reluctant to take up this matter? Why was it such a hot potato when, like you said, it came from a politically popular governor and seems to enjoy quite a bit of support from voters?
Well, I think part of what was going on is anything connected with the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, was seen as toxic. And I don't think we were ever able to get over that hurdle of adequately explaining this is not Obamacare, this is not an expansion of Medicaid, but this is a unique public insurance program designed specifically for Tennessee. And for me, I looked at it from the standpoint of, is this good health policy? And even the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Tennessee said Insure Tennessee would have a positive impact on the health status of the state's population. It would improve access to health care, improve the efficiency of medical care delivery, lower insurance rates among veterans, and increase financial stability for rural hospitals. And on top of that, the Center for Business and Economic Research said Insure Tennessee will have a positive impact on the or bring financial benefits to the state economy. $1.03 billion in new healthcare revenues, over $900 million in new income for residents of the state and 15,000 full-time equivalent jobs. So we really had a unique situation of sound health policy as well as financial benefits to our state.
Would you say that it was a communication gap? If you had to describe the cause for why Ensure Tennessee failed in that special session and really didn't come back in the regular session in 15, was it because, like you said, it was so hard to communicate this idea that it was a separate concept? Was that the failure point?
Yes. Well, in part, and I'm sure like many things, there are many causes.
Right.
But the governor announced this plan on December 15, 2014, which is when he got approval from CMS. But then we go back into session the second Tuesday of January of 2015. The special session was early February. And I really don't think there was enough time between December 15 and February 1 to really communicate, to meet individually with members of the House and Senate. And I would say it did come back up later in the session in March. And at that point, we were successful through the first committee, the Senate Health Committee. We were successful in March. The bill then went to the Senate Commerce Committee, where it again met with its demise. But I think from February, the first week of February, to when it came back up in March, attitudes and positions had simply hardened rather than being developed. And by then, unfortunately, my colleagues' positions had hardened.
Which leads me right to my next question, which is what the options might be from here. There's been some talk, for instance, that the General Assembly may wait until after the next president is inaugurated in January of 2017 to take any action on Ensure Tennessee, because they want to see if maybe the federal laws might change. And if there's a party shift in Washington, there might be some movement there. So what are you hearing about that, or perhaps other options that would help us sort of outline the future of Ensure Tennessee?
Well, I think, unfortunately, I have not seen any real change of attitudes among my colleagues in the Senate and the House of Representatives. And I think that's why you haven't seen Governor Haslam put this back on the agenda. You may have noticed in the State of the State address just this past Monday, Ensure Tennessee wasn't mentioned. And so I think in part there's been no real change of attitudes. And secondly, I do think folks are taking a wait-and-see attitude as to what happens in the national elections in November, because you've had mainly every candidate on the Republican side saying the first thing they're going to do is repeal Obamacare.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see, of course, how all that shapes up, and we may have you back for another discussion after all that as this shapes up, too. Doug Overby, a state senator from Merrillville. Last year, he sponsored legislation that would have enacted Ensure Tennessee. That's Governor Bill Haslam's compromise plan that would have opened up health insurance access to about 280,000 Tennesseans. He joined us on his phone from his office in Nashville near the Capitol building. Senator Overby, thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here and talk about the health care for the people of Tennessee. This continues to be an important decision. I think Ensure Tennessee was really a conservative plan put forward by a conservative governor to meet the health care needs of Tennesseans all across the state.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye. We're going to pause right now for a station break. When we come back, Ed Curtis, the Chief Executive Officer for Summit Medical Group and Associate Professor in the UT College of Nursing, Carol Myers. Stay right where you are. We'll also open up the phone lines in the second half of the show and take your questions about health insurance and health policy in Tennessee as Dialogue continues from WUOT News. Twenty minutes after 1 o'clock on this Wednesday afternoon, and Dialogue continues here on listener-supported public radio, 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and we are joined in this second portion of the show by two guests in our studio. Ed Curtis, he's the Chief Executive Officer of the Summit Medical Group, And Carol Myers, an associate professor in the UT College of Nursing, one of her specialties is public health policy. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks for being with us today. An interesting start to the show. We wanted to ask some political questions, and so we got a legislator to answer them. Now we have some, of course, questions for both of you as well. But I want to start with what we just heard from Senator Overby right before the break. In that conversation, we talked about some of the ways in which Ensure Tennessee was designed to work, what actually happened to it. We also talked about how some legislators are talking about waiting until President Obama is out of office before revisiting this issue because they want to see if there's going to be a change in Washington that might affect things here in Tennessee. And in fact, the Tennessee Hospital Association is already looking in that direction. Late last month, the Associated Press reported the Hospital Association is already starting to spend some money on a renewed push, but they're holding that for 2017, after the next inauguration. Let's start our discussion from right there, and we can start maybe with you, Dr. Myers, about what came out of Ensure Tennessee and some of those discussions, and what do you think that crystal ball might hold for Ensure Tennessee in the near future?
Okay. Well, certainly understand that policy is made in a political environment, and mm-hmm. we certainly saw that in the discussion about Ensure Tennessee last year. But I'd like to bring the focus back to public policy, mm-hmm. of which Ensure Tennessee is an example, is government's response to problems. Those problems haven't gone away. As a matter of fact, they're getting worse. And I'll just give you two indicators. When we look at America's Health Rankings, a very reputable, sustainable report, we rank 43 out of 51. And that's on our health status. We are plagued by problems related to our health behaviors, our physical environment, our public and health policies, and the clinical care we receive here in Tennessee. If we look at another set of metrics from the Commonwealth Fund about how our system operates, again, we're 43 out of 51. We have major problems related to avoidable hospital use, how healthy we are, and equity of our healthcare delivery system. So I don't want us to lose sight of that fact that when we talk about postponing, looking at solutions, there are people suffering because of that.
And Ed, you have anything to add to, because you're on the medical care side of this debate as well. I mean, it's not merely academic for you or political. It's going to be the way your business operates.
Sure. We really don't like to venture into that political space.
Sure,
we look
sure.
at it from the business of medicine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We reviewed it, and we see that the millions of dollars, some people even say hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars, are headed out of Tennessee by virtue of us making this decision. Tennessee taxpayer dollars being collected through the Affordable Care Act are headed to the other states that have expanded their Medicaid programs.
Mm-hmm.
From a business perspective, all of us sit back behind the desk, the business mind, you know, whether it's health care or not. Do we want Tennesseans paying for other people's health care coverage? Mm-hmm. The second piece is that it was mentioned earlier that we do have outcomes, as better health care outcomes, when we have more insured population, more insured Tennesseans. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have today. That Affordable Care Act doesn't cover everybody. There
right.
are folks that are being missed, and those folks that are being missed, Governor Haslam put together a program that picks up those folks that are missed initially. And, you know, in the healthcare business, we believe that the insured public, we can provide better outcomes for their healthcare.
Yeah. I also want to remind all of our listeners here, we're getting close to the bottom of the hour. You can give us a call at 974-5050. We'd like to hear your questions about health insurance or health care in Tennessee. You can also tweet us at WUOTFM. You can send us a question via our website, WUOT.org. There's a big block in the middle of the front page, and you can submit your questions at WUOT.org as well. What did the failure of Insurance Tennessee mean for, and I want to break this down by group, mean for consumers here in Tennessee, Dr. Myers? What would they have noticed by that?
Well, I think we need to look at this two ways. We need to look at the individuals that are caught in the gap,
yeah.
that do not have expanded health care coverage through the Affordable Care Act. And these are the folks, the 280,000 Tennesseans that Senator Overby mentioned, that don't have access to affordable health care. But then I think we need to look at our overall picture in Tennessee, and we are all impacted by this. Medicaid expansion, or Ensure Tennessee, which is a a custom program,
right,
protects not just low-income Tennesseans, but all Tennesseans. And one of the areas that I think is most easy to grab a hold of is our local hospitals, that there are provisions in the Affordable Care Act that actually make it harder for some rural hospitals to remain solvent. If we look at admissions for 2013, 31% of those admissions in Tennessee were for folks that are in this area, that are in the gap, and it puts those hospitals at, you know, the threat of having to close because of not being financially solvent. That affects all of us because your hospitals often are the largest employers. They're used to attract businesses to the area. Of course, they have a direct impact on the health and health care of people in that community. So I think we need to look at it from the individuals that are impacted, the veterans, the working poor, but also what it does to our overall economy because we're so interconnected.
Right, right. Well, Ed, I want to turn back to you then for that too. What did the failure of Insure Tennessee mean for folks in your business, you and your colleagues, the people you talk to that are involved in the same business? You alluded to this a little earlier with loss of money to other states. What are some of the other effects you may have noticed by not having Insure Tennessee in this state?
Well, for us, it's the 280,000 lives. How many reside in East Tennessee?
Right.
Don't have statistics for that. But all those people, all those citizens, you already have that. Is that
yeah.
right, Carol?
Yeah.
You have them? Well, I don't have those numbers, but our goal and our mission with Summit Medical Group is to provide the best quality health care for all East Tennesseans. We want to be able to do that. But you have that component, and Carol has the numbers, she might be able to share that are in East Tennessee right now, of the 280,000, that we can't see, we don't touch. And that becomes a pent-up medical demand.
Hmm.
You know, and it's not healthy. What happens is people postpone getting good health care. They have to deal with their disease state today and not be able to reach out to a physician. And then when they finally do, because it's a mandatory item for them, because it's the difference between the quality of life and also survival, then they end up in the highest cost of health care that we have is running through the ER.
Because that by that point, it's reached an extreme level,
because they didn't
do preventative care or something.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And I think it's important that it's not just preventive care.
Mm-hmm.
It's managing the disease, and they need to have that physician reviewing and manage proactively their disease so they don't end up in ER.
Right. And that's such an interesting sort of, I guess to me, because I don't work in the medical industry and I don't study it nearly as closely as you guys do, it's almost a chicken and egg sort of problem where it's like, yes, the South has generally worse health than other parts of the country in a lot of ways, incidence of stroke, obesity, diabetes. They could be managed in such a way, but then you've got these other factors to consider about why they're not managing it. How do we go about, I guess I should just ask this question directly, how do we fix this? How do we do all of this? You know, and what role perhaps that adequate health insurance plays in that sort of more balanced picture of actually trying to get people well or keep them well?
Mm-hmm. Well, access to high-quality, cost-effective health care in some regards is low-hanging fruit. We know it has an impact on overall health, but there are many other which are more indirect factors that have more major impact. We know that the number one determinant of your health is your socioeconomic status. So let me just tie this together with another one of Governor Haslam's policies, which is increasing the number of Tennesseans with high school educations.
Right, right.
We actually have seen an improvement in our ranking, and this will indirectly impact health. But healthcare more directly, even though it's not the most major factor. So I think we need to be looking at this not as a single solution or a single solution that we've create today and lasts forever. We need to look across factors, and we need to continually adjust what we're doing. This is very complicated.
Yeah, and no doubt about that at the federal and state level. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services says the ACA is combating huge premium hikes in insurance by requiring insurers to justify their costs, requests for increases in premiums. The federal government defines that as 10% increase or more in a given year. But Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee, the state's largest health insurer, received approval to hike its rates an average of 33% this year. That's one of the highest percentage increases anywhere in the United States this year. What happened, Ed?
I'll take that, Carol.
All right.
Good.
This is a question that those of us in the healthcare field we have to review this constantly. We hear it frequently about, you know, the ACA had these exchanges whereby we were going to insure more Tennesseans. Now, this is usually a very long-winded response, which we don't have the time for today. So I'm gonna give you
the elevator version.
Yes,
about that.
The elevator version for today. Here's the short story. The large, sophisticated payers in the country do a remarkable job of predicting the cost of health care for their covered lives, and they're experts at it. Whether you like what they pay or don't, you know. For a provider organization, sometimes we're not always happy with the reimbursement benefits that they provide. But at the end, they're very good at predicting the cost of health care. And the actuarial work that they do is all based on things that we know.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on the history. It's based on what happened to these patients 24 months ago, 18 months ago, 12 months ago. When we went into the ACA program in the exchange, these were all uninsured lives.
Right.
There was zero history, nothing for the insurers to look at this work to predict how much it would cost. So you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And keep in mind, they're experts at what they do, but they didn't know this. I said it earlier, right? The pent-up demand of healthcare. All these people who needed help, who needed a good provider, who needed some type of healthcare service, have been postponing and postponing. So all of a sudden, the exchange is open. And of course, once we get by the technical difficulties of signing up, we finally get them enrolled. And all these people flood the healthcare gates because they need all this healthcare. They need to get back on track. They need the diabetics need to get their A1C checked. And it's on and on. And no one could have predicted that the premium necessary to cover the utilization was going to be there. I'm not sure anybody could have been able to predict that.
Well, and is it also accurate that in our first go around, whereas now we had the largest rate increase or among the largest,
mm-hmm.
that initially we had some of the lowest rates. So, you know, we missed it on both sides in some regards. But I'm with you. I agree. The experience will inform us. And this is the thing about policy. You have to continually make incremental improvements.
Yeah.
You know, and startups, be it in business or be it in the Affordable Care Act, are a pretty risky business.
It is. You can't expect somebody to get it right the first time. We'd like to. You know, many of us on the business side, we say, let's get it right the first time. Let's not go down the path we've already done, right? Let's get it right. This was too big. There were how many hundreds of millions of uninsured when this started before?
Depends on whose numbers, but some numbers were over 50 million in the U.S.
Wow.
So uninsured that all of a sudden stepped forward and said, I need all this work. I need to get healthy again. And no one could have predicted the cost.
Exactly what was going to happen because it was unprecedented. Again, you can tweet your questions at WUOTFM. You can give us a call at 974-5050. And we're continuing along with our guests on Dialogue today right now about half, 1:35. Time flies when you're having fun and a good discussion. Last month in Nashville, Tennessee, and reported the increases were larger than perhaps had been expected because of what you were talking about, Ed. People who had already signed up for coverage and then getting the help under the coverage skewed older and sicker than perhaps had been anticipated. And what I want to ask about that is that a statistical anomaly because there's an initial rush, or is that the shape of things to come? Is that going to be the new normal under the ACA?
Well, how many of us that work today that have health insurance as part of our benefits package?
Right.
In the past 10 years, have we ever had a time where we sat down with the management team and didn't have an increase for covering our employee lives? So to answer your question, I think the exaggerated increase that took place initially is because we didn't know what to expect.
Right.
So to answer your question, no, I don't think we should expect 25 and 30% increases year after year,
right?
Because they're going to start using that same type of data. The payers are going to be using that data that they use in the commercial space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's going to price the product correctly, and we'll finally get to a place where it will be incrementally higher, but it won't be those double-digit increases because of this unknown factor.
Yeah. And I think that's true. I think the profile of the enrollees, which I think will change over time, And I think the experience, which is of which the premiums are based on, I think another factor that's important, and we haven't realized it yet, is the managed competition that's built in to the design of the program. Yes. So we are not seeing the downward effects of competition yet in these marketplaces that have been created. So, you know, I think we need to pay some attention to that, particularly Governor Haslam's plan, which, again, I think is innovative and moderate and will have some impact, but I don't think it's immediate.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we're going to turn to our first caller right now. Bill from Knoxville, you're on the air with us here on Dialogue. Go right ahead with your question.
Yes, sir. I'm curious as to what percentage or rough numbers of the people who became insured under law, by law under the ACA, mm-hmm. insured for the first time, that have defaulted on their insurance premiums because they can't afford them.
See, that's a great question. It's something I wanted to get into a little later in this hour. Do we have any kind of indication about that yet? Or is this one of these unknown unknowns?
We don't have access to that data today. It would have mm-hmm. to be something that would be published by the feds, I would think, would be right. the best okay. place to be able to get that. Maybe even at the state level, you might be able to get that.
Right.
But we don't see any of that data.
Okay. Well, so but I want to take Bill's comment and spring off that because I think it is actually quite fascinating. I was thinking about that a lot this morning. Here in Tennessee, when Medicaid was not expanded, TennCare was not expanded, people whose incomes are under the poverty level or under like a tax reporting threshold had very few options, it seems like. The most basic plans, which are called catastrophic plans or bronze level plans for some folks, have really high deductibles, you know, for people who don't have a lot of money to begin with, up to $6,800 in some cases. And all of that kind of gives me the impression, and please correct me if I'm wrong, we had two experts here, tell me if I'm wrong, the impression is you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place for people in that group because you're either paying out high premiums every month for money that you may not have to begin with or is a stretch for you to make every month, or you're going to go with a lower plan with a higher deductible, so when you do go visit the doctor, you're still paying a lot of money. Is that about right?
That's about right, and I think yes. that's why most of us that are in this business are most concerned about the affordability of the health care because there's only your financial income is finite, and the poorer you are, the more you feel those boundaries of the income that you have, and you have to make hard choices.
Yeah.
So definitely, and there are so many different areas that are potentially unaffordable, be it the premiums, be it the deductibles, the co-pays, et cetera. So you've hit on what I think is one of the most significant problems that we need to continue to look at.
Which is interesting because the word affordable is the first word in the Affordable Care Act,
right.
And yet it is it's a challenge. You know, maybe it exists on paper, but it's very different in practice.
Well, and then I would go back, though, Brandon, I'm sorry, excuse me, to this idea about political and what is affordable.
Yeah.
Is the only measure of affordability the cost of the premiums or the cost of the deductible? Because we're paying other ways. So
yes,
I think we need to look at that.
Yeah, Ed, you were going to throw in there?
I was. It's a matter of perspective. You know, what's affordable? And when we look at this, I think it was short-sighted on many that to hit this, I think one statistic I read not too long ago is the average deductible is like $4,200 for that. Mm. That could be catastrophic for many families.
Sure.
The sales on the ACA program was that it's catastrophic insurance. You're going to have this high deductible,
mm-hmm.
and when you really get sick and you end up in the hospital or you need bypass surgery, something that's going to prevent
yeah.
you from having to pay $50,000, $80,000. But what we didn't realize are the people who fall in this category, the people who are the working poor, so to speak,
right.
$4,000 it is a catastrophic number for them to have to be able to pay.
Yeah. We're going to continue this discussion, of course, on the other side of a station break. We're going to pause right now at 20 minutes before the hour. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth with Ed Curtis and Carol Myers as you're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You're listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. We're online at WUOT.org. Don't forget, you can submit your questions online. Go to our website, WUOT.org. Use the box at the center of the page. You can also give us a call at 974-5050. Our discussion about health care and health insurance continues now. And so we left off by talking about a lot of the negatives and some of the scary parts of this getting insurance and affordability and things like that. What recourse do Tennesseans have? So we know we don't have Insure Tennessee, but the ACA is still in effect. There's kind of a gap between what the federal government wants, what the state is actually doing, and it leaves a lot of people to do on their own what needs to be done. How do you keep rates low, still have adequate health coverage, and what options exist for Tennesseans under the law as it stands right now?
Well, I think, Brandon, when we talk about the folks caught in the gap, obviously those are the folks that have not benefited from the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
But we have had certain segments of the population that definitely have benefited, those that were able to go into Medicaid that weren't there before. And certainly there's been some impact on the private sector. So, you know, there are good things happening. We have more Tennesseans covered. We have that group that was particularly vulnerable because they thought they were invulnerable, the young adults who are now covered at a higher rate. So I think we have a tendency to do this in public policy, and I think in a lot of other areas, that we look at the negative rather than the positive. But there's been some very good results of the Affordable Care Act in Tennessee. And those folks that are covered generally, once they access the healthcare system, have pretty high satisfaction. There's a lot of folks that get the insurance and don't access the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. So that's another issue, or get the insurance and don't know how to use it. So, I mean, there's good things happening, but there's things that we need to continually work on. That's not going to go away anytime soon.
And Ed, what are some of the other maybe good points about this? We spent a lot of time this hour talking about the negatives and some of the disincentives and things like that. What are some of the positives and some of the benefits that you've witnessed on your side?
Well, I think Carol summed it up. It's being able, for those people that were covered when ACA came out, mm-hmm. it allowed them access to the health care system. And we all know that when you're getting good health care, the quality of life is better, and Tennesseans deserve to have the best health care available and be able to afford it.
Yeah.
You know, a shameless plug for the listeners out there.
Yeah.
We have one of our own, Dr. Leahy, mm-hmm. who wrote an opinion in the New Sentinel in January 9th of this year.
Okay.
And it's a really nice piece for people who want to see a perspective from a physician who also works very hard in Washington to help move legislation in the direction of providing better health care. But you can see a lot of what he had to say from a physician's perspective. I think it's important that people read what Dr. Leahy had to say.
Well, it also indicates that this is this sort of multifaceted, almost a layer cake kind of approach. We're not just talking about the uninsured and the insured, but yes. hospitals, doctors, insurers.
Yes.
There are a lot of people who are affected by the answers to these questions.
Brenda, can I add another very important point that affects those that have insurance as well as that have private insurance as well as those public mm-hmm. insurance? The Affordable Care Act is based on this premise that we actually need to change the delivery of health care. And there are several areas that we see this. One is we have 100% coverage for many preventative services. So that idea that we want to prevent the establishment or progression of chronic disease. So that's a major move. There's more of an emphasis in the Affordable Care Act on primary health care services, which is one of the things that distinguish us in a bad way from countries that have better health outcomes. Mm. It's to build a more robust primary care system so that we can treat people closer to home, earlier in the progression of disease, or even prevent disease. So when we talk about some of the good effects of the Affordable Care Act, and then I think on the reimbursement level, money is the lever to change behavior, and we need to change the behavior across the healthcare delivery system about what we value and what we do. And when we have bundled payments, when we have pay for performance, we have the levers that will ultimately change how we address healthcare, how we become more coordinated, how we care more about patient outcomes mm-hmm. and patients' values and patient satisfaction with the care they receive. So I think there's these things that aren't being talked about.
We'll go to the phone lines once more. Riv from Knoxville, go right ahead.
Yes, hello. My name is Riv.
Mm-hmm.
First time calling in, actually a long-time fan. This is a very important issue. lives of people affect any of their inconveniences and lifestyles and such, healthcare. I was curious, this might be a unique question, but I was in the military for a time, and it's a different environment. It's not about money. It's about unity, the mission, et cetera, et cetera. And the Hippocratic Oath was just understood. It was not a question of can it be covered, it's to do it. In the civilian world, unfortunately, not so much. So my question is, with that in mind, with the possibility of something like single payer coming through, which I think would be better for everyone, how does that conflict immediately and then perhaps in the long term with what some of these proposals with the extension and the perhaps retrofission of the current health care plans in action right now?
Okay, that's a pretty detailed question. And Carol, what do you think about that?
I think I'll try to take a stab at it.
Okay.
I'm glad you've decided to do that.
Well, thank you. Like I said, I'm going to take a stab. Riv, thank you for your question. When we look at people's opinions or perspectives, we look at what they believe, and then we also look at how strongly they believe it. So how many people believe this, and how strongly do they believe? The single-payer advocates in our country are by no means a majority, but one of the things that characterizes them is how strongly held their beliefs are. So let me set that aside and move to the second point, which was my very first point, is that policy is made in a political environment. And in our current political environment, I don't think you're going to see much traction today. That could change over time for a single-payer system. It's just so radically different than what we have today, and so radically different than some strongly held American values. So I think it's an idea that certain people feel very strongly about. I think it's an idea with merit. I don't think it has legs right now in our country.
Okay. All right, we're going to go to another caller. We've got Louise on the line in Knoxville. I believe Knoxville. It just says North America on my screen. So I presume Knoxville's in there somewhere. Louise, you're on Dialogue. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, this is Knoxville. Thank you.
Very good.
And I'm a proud BSN graduate of the UT Nursing School, and my husband's also a physician. So we've been dealing with just policies for a long time.
And, I'm sure, yeah.
And I try to tell everyone that I think that this healthcare reform is more of a process than a policy.
Right.
And that we are looking at the process, and some things don't work, and some things do work. And I work with people that are struggling, nurses, aides, et cetera, struggling every day to get the health care that they deserve. And some of them don't have health care at all. But mm-hmm. I guess my question is, I feel as though since this has been labeled Obamacare, that it's just going to be thrown out the window if someone else gets elected, mm-hmm. which I think is not just sad, but almost tragic, because there's really things that we need to save about it. And I really appreciate both of your people on the show today trying to give a balanced look at this.
Yeah.
Do they see any way that... Well, how would they, for instance, one of your, the head of summit said we don't like to get out of politics.
Right, right.
But is that really possible?
Oof.
I guess that's my question.
You know, that, let me
it
turn
It seems
that...
to be so
yeah.
loaded.
Right, right.
Emotion.
Louise, let me take that to our panel, because I think that's exactly right. I mean, this intersection of science, medical care, business, and also with politics, it is almost inescapable, is it not?
Well, again, policy is made and improved and tinkered with and repealed in a political environment. But I want to go back to this idea that policy is meant to be public policy, government's response to problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we hear a lot of what I would call saber rattling about repealing the Affordable Care Act. And I don't know if that's going to happen or not happen after the next election. But what I do know is that the problems that prompted the enactment of the Affordable Care Act have not gone away. And without those problems would probably be Without that act, the problems would probably be exacerbated. So I think it's incumbent upon us to demand that our government does what it's supposed to do, and that's address societal problems. It's not pretty. It's often very messy. It doesn't happen on the timeline we want, but, you know, it's just the way it is.
Right, and it does, like, I really like that she said it's a process and not a policy. It's
right.
Very often the wheels of government or bureaucracy grind slowly and not very elegantly.
Well, and Brandon, the term we use, policy professionals, is it's incremental. Mm-hmm. Very rarely do you have a wide-sweeping public policy that doesn't undergo change over time. Medicare is a classic example. If you just think for a few minutes of the history of Medicare and how we've changed reimbursement, mm-hmm. what's covered, who's covered, this is just part, the nature of the beast.
Yeah. All right. Well, Louise, thank you so much for that. That was really interesting, and thank you for sharing that perspective as somebody in the medical profession as well. Eden from Knoxville, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Okay. First, can I make a statement?
Briefly.
In 1946, Harry Truman introduced socialized medicine or the Affordable Care Act or whatever you want to call it. So the comment becomes, why did it take 68 years to get it? Secondly, it cost per dollar in the United States 26 cents administrative cost. In Canada, it cost 11 cents. I want your comments. I don't want to beat around the, don't want you to beat around the bush. I want frank answers. Thank you, and have a good day.
All right, you too. Thank you, Eden. And his question, as was noted on our little producer screen here, is why does it seem to cost more for health care here in the United States, perhaps? I can't back up his numbers, the 26 cents versus 11 cents, so I can't vouch for that. But is there a difference in the cost of providing that health care, and maybe what explains that?
I'll take a stab at that, if you don't mind.
All righty.
So we know that the United States has one of the highest cost of health care per capita in the world, and we don't always have similar outcomes. I think mm-hmm. Carol mentioned earlier, you know, out of the top 50 industrialized nations, you know, we sit very close to the bottom. For me, living in this space, in the business of health care, there are many ways for us to begin streamlining the cost of health care. You know, I'm very defensive about the group of folks out there, and this is my political venture for a moment, that want to solve the health care problems across the nation by reducing physician incomes. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the pie and all the components of the cost of health care, a piece of it belongs in the physician compensation component, but the waste and the redundancy. I had a live story after speaking with our chairman, Dr. Montgomery, this morning. Mm-hmm. You know, he talked about a patient that presented on last Thursday, did some blood work, did a CT, and said, I'm going to work on this diagnosis. We're going to reschedule a time to meet on Monday. Things didn't go well. By Friday, mm-hmm. this particular patient went to the ER. And because of, you know, once again, whether you favor ACA or not, right. you know, the interoperability of electronic systems is invaluable in saving us an enormous amount of expenditures. This particular incident, when this patient presented in the ER, what do you think happened in the ER? Another CT, yep. another lab, where the interoperability from 2 days ago already had a CT, already had a lab. So when Dr. Montgomery and I discussed this today, you know, it's how do we, in our own little microcosm, in our own little zip code we're operating, how can we cut down that redundant cost there? That's not because of the physician in the ER. That's not because of the physician, you know, that the PCP, Dr. Montgomery. Mm-hmm. It's a system problem.
Yeah.
And that happens every day, all day. And we have to work better at being able to do that.
Well, let me ask you what steps you might be taking at your company to do that. What is Summit doing to kind of help increase those lines of communication, reduce yes. the redundancies and those costs?
Sure. Great question. It's relevant because just in the last 30 days, we had our IT staff working with a couple of the local hospitals in being able to provide them access to our health record. Now, Meaningful Use 3, it's the next iteration of ACA and providing a system mm-hmm. for national EMR, electronic medical record.
Okay.
Interoperability is going to be Meaningful Use 3's chief component.
Okay.
And we're trying to get out in front of that right now. So for us, not having two systems that match, but at least providing access – So a physician in one of the local hospitals that would like to see the electronic medical record or the chart, in most people's terms, of this particular patient, we're working on that component as we speak.
And it sounds like it'd be better for the patient, too, because you're not having to go through all that stuff more than once,
yes,
you know, to begin with.
Great point.
Very briefly, because we're going to run out of time here very shortly, we have a question from Twitter. Kentucky, our neighbors to the north, call their Obama health plan Kinect, and seems to be more accepted there. Could something as simple as a name change work in Tennessee? That question via Twitter from Amanda Leatherin. What about a name change? Doug Overby at the top of the show said, even the name, even the mere perception of a connection to something else made it poison for the legislature. Could changing the nomenclature do something?
You know, from my perspective, this was good legislation.
Yeah.
And it absolutely fell in the political arena. It was a partisan vote. And we said it earlier, we don't like to venture into that space. It had a lot of good things. I said it earlier, you know, lots of Tennesseans are, via our tax dollars, are supporting Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And that's a good example.
Yeah.
And we just shouldn't have to do that right now.
Yeah, I would answer this question slightly differently. Thank you, Amanda, for the question. One is, I don't think we're going to have a discussion get traction unless there's an election, and I mean the election here in Tennessee, mm-hmm. and the election at the federal level. I think it's going to take that. Mm. Brendan, may I make one comment on what Ed said about just a minute ago?
Sure, yeah.
Ed, I totally agree with the waste in the system, and I think the promise of electronic health records and interoperability. But I would have answered that question slightly different, or I would add this. What's different here in the United States relative to cost? I think it's two B words. One is, you mentioned the business of healthcare. Mm. That's unique to the United States that we think about it that way. And then I think the other thing, which is really not well received in the United States, is the fact that we don't have budgets. We talk about cost controls, but we really don't have budgets. So when you look at international healthcare systems, those two B words are, I think, where we differ from France, from Great Britain, mm-hmm. from Canada. So, but this is what Americans want. We like our business environment, we like competition, and we don't like budgets.
Sure.
Well, there's so much more to talk about with this subject. We got about a minute left in the show. Let me ask you, and maybe you can give me very, very brief answers on this one. This is one that's submitted via our website as part of the Truck Beat Project. Again, very briefly, a very basic question, but fascinating. Are Tennesseans who signed up for health insurance any healthier now than they were before the ACA? Do we have any metrics on that?
We generally divide metrics into two categories, mm-hmm. process measures. Are you getting your checkups? Are you getting your mm-hmm. mammogram, your immunizations? And there's an uptick there because coverage is available and it's emphasized. Yep. But then what you really want to look at is outcomes, and the horizon on that is longer. So I'm not sure that we have those metrics yet, but we have the process measures that are linked to the outcome measures.
Dr. Carol Myers of the University of Tennessee College of Nursing. She studies public health policy. And Ed Curtis, the CEO of Summit Medical Group. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, indeed. And thank you to everybody who called in and submitted questions today on Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You can visit us online at WUOT.org.